We did it to show the world how important creativity is and that technology can help us to be more creative. We're not saying that AI is replacing us. We would like to give that algorithm to the world and have fun and create. Only less than 2% of the world is living off of creativity. As kids, we are super creative. Something is happening. We need to be more creative. And that's my mantra. Be creative with everything. You can be creative in business. You can be creative driving the car differently. Take a different route the next day and start with little steps and write music, write poetry, paint, invent something. Just enjoy it.
This week's guest is sound inventor Walter Warzawa. Walter has lived an extraordinary life. From his inspiring film scores, globally recognized audio branding, to creating music as medicine, creativity through sound has powered Walter's life journey. I met Walter in March here in Austin at South by Southwest when out for a drink with an old colleague from McCann, New York. On hearing Walter's inspiring story, I decided I had to interview him. Walter kindly agreed, but we had to wait until he was back in Austria. In the interview, Walter recounts the early influence of his parents and how from childhood music has defined his identity and life arc, and how serendipity has certainly played its part, from the purchase of a keyboard in Vienna to arriving in LA to study film scoring. Serendipity has created pathways to finding mentors, composing for Disney, making connections that led him to create the legendary Intel Inside Audio mnemonic, to building successful audio agency, to ultimately applying his expertise in sound to create his HealthTunes startup, described as music as medicine. Walter's story is one that is powered by his curiosity, his creativity, and unwavering persistence. He also provides much inspiration and advice to others on striving for balance, the importance of focusing on the present, and the power of embracing your difference. For listeners of the podcast, you might remember when we interviewed Emily Oberman from Pentagram, and she described it as embracing herself as a beautiful weirdo. I think you'll be inspired by the musical journey of Walter Warzawa.
All right, Walter, welcome to the Impossible Network podcast. Thank you very much for making the time all the way from Vienna and Austria.
Hey, Mark, so good seeing you. Talking to you again last time in Austin. Now Vienna, what's the next city?
Yeah, Los Angeles, maybe. Who knows?
Yeah.
So before we talk about your really interesting journey as what I believe you call yourself as a sound inventor and also a founder, entrepreneur, and founder of HealthTunes, could we really dive into your backstory and understand a bit more about where you come from and the influences? I believe you were born and raised in Vienna, Austria, mm-hmm. to a conservative family, four brothers, mm-hmm. and with doctors as parents. Mm-hmm. So really be fascinated having heard you talk about a little bit about your parental upbringing, the influence of your parents and particularly your father in the journey and the guidance and support they gave you.
Isn't it amazing how our parents influence us and how shocking it is now to know how we influence our kids? And I think I came to the awareness there is no perfect parent and don't even try to be perfect. And that really created a lot of peace with my upbringing. It's like my upbringing was, I think, different. I did not talk. I didn't say one single word until I was three. And so my parents...
Fear?
I can't remember. And I also blocked out my childhood for the most part of it. But I think I'm a good listener. And I think that helps me in what I'm doing, music. My wife loves to talk. And it's just great to listen to her. And sometimes there are stretches of 10 minutes and just like to take it in and observe. And I think that turned into a special gift for me to observe, to be very analytic, and then do something with the information and not just get scattered right away. And the interesting part was, apparently after those 3 years, suddenly there was this one day where I talked in full sentences. It was from zero to talking, and it just happened this way. Maybe it's also... sometimes I believe I hear the world differently, and who knows how you really see and hear the world. I can only assume you listen and see a similar world than I have. But the older I get, even thinking, I think we all have such different experiences. sometimes we see and hear the same thing and have such a different perspective on it and the context, and that makes it so beautiful that we all.
That's really interesting. I never thought about the concept of our senses, our hearing, that we might hear things differently. I mean, obviously you can interpretation of what you hear someone say, but the sounds around us, I've never thought about that, and that someone might hear different sounds and be on a different spectrum to someone else. That's fascinating.
I think that's plausible. And hearing is so important. Blind people see through audio. They can do that, like that clicking sound. It assesses space and even textures.
And like bats.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like the reflections you get. And we can transform with changing sound, and that's what we do in immersive experiences now. You can record your Foley sound, your movement, the clothing and the clothes and the steps and whispers and breathing, and transport us into something totally different. And our brains believe that right away. And that's also the power of VR, that even though we walk on this imaginary board like, and walk over like the seventh floor of a skyscraper, and we know we are safe. We know logically we're safe, but it's hard to walk out there. And even if this is just a drawn space. So I think our mind can be tricked so immensely and guided and also calmed. I mean, and that brings me to music medicine. I think we can do so much with sound. And in audio branding, we can lure people to buy more or less, to eat faster, to eat slower, whatever you want. And the power of sound is astronomical.
Do you remember, I mean, given, I believe that you didn't, I've heard you in another interview talk about how you weren't exposed to, let's say, rock and roll or contemporary music until you were probably in your early teens. But do you remember at an early age when you became aware of the power of sound and music, or attuned to it? And were, I mean, I know you've got brothers, was it just you, or were you all of you very similar in terms of your musical interest and I suppose talent?
So my older brother is almost 2 years older. And I know we kind of discovered that there's another world out there than classic music. And you know, those were the days you would walk into a shopping in the mall and there was no sound there. It's like you didn't have like ubiquitous sound.
We didn't have shopping malls in Scotland in the 60s.
Yeah, or it's like a shop was quiet. It's like you hear people talk, but there was no music. The cars, you didn't automatically turn the radio on. If the radio was turned on, it was the father's or the mother's wish. Now it's the opposite. It's like we can't listen to the music we want to. It's all about the kids now. And everything is shifting. And you walk in an elevator, hear music. And you walk into a stairwell, hear music. And the gym has music. And it's always music. And there's, I think it's too much sound there. And we're always in this bubble. But at that time, there was a lot of silence. And I really am happy that I lived through that world of silence as well. Then when I was 13 and in school, we went to the ski weekend. And I only had listened to classic music so far and was never exposed to anything else. And suddenly at the first dinner, there was a jukebox and somebody put his shilling in and listen to Nutbush City, and I've never heard a sound like this. And for me, I think it was an experience. I've never had something as strong before or after. It was physically, it downed me. I could sit and not move, and it was just incredible to hear those sounds, those harmonies, the rhythm. It's everything, that incredibly sexiness, that rawness, that energy, that beat. It was just a new world. I think it was, if I would put you on Mars now, you would get stunned. And I only had something similar going on roughly 30 years later when I was in Los Angeles coming home from USC, and listened to radio, and I heard Samuel Barber, the Adagio for Strings, for the first time. And again, it's like I had to get off the freeway and park there because I couldn't move anymore. It was just, it's like an incredible drug experience. It's like all my hormones and chemicals got mixed up, the dopamines and prolactins, and it transported me to somewhere totally different.
So, I mean, that clearly sort of defining moment in your early life set you, was that a moment when you suddenly went in a different direction with your ambitions and your desire to pursue a career in music? I mean, was it something when you had, when that sort of experience, when you returned from that trip, did you say to your parents, right, okay, this is how I want to focus my career in music?
Wish it was.
Or were those ambitions?
That profound. It was much simpler.
Because it sounds like quite a cathartic experience, just having this, or not cathartic really, but it's that transformative.
Absolutely, absolutely correct. It was, I still can't find the right words to that. It was just overwhelming and incredible, powerful, physical, emotional, like everything. But my wish to do music was something much simpler. I was very shy and not into dialogue. And once you're 13 years old and a boy and realize that there are the girls in class, but they only, from my perspective, looked at the guys who played music, and it was so easy, and with this one guy who played guitar and all the girls were always around him. I said, oh my God, I have to learn guitar. That will solve any of my challenges and problems. So fortunately, one of the assistants of my father at the office, at the doctoral office, said she wants to take guitar classes, and if I want to join, it's like everything fell into place, I can do it. And so I joined the first class, and I was mesmerized by the sound of the guitar and how it was a young teacher who played, and I was glued to it, and I wanted to have a guitar, and my parents were great in that sense, got me a guitar, and from then on I just played, I think, first 2 hours a day.
Presumably you're already a musician and trained in piano or some other instrument.
Yeah, I had piano classes, and we have music in school, and it is something powerful, but it was not clear to myself or anybody I want to be a musician. I didn't think that far. It's just seeing the friend on the guitar and swarmed around, it was like, oh my God, I want that. And then I just practiced and practiced and practiced. And after a year, I practiced much more than anybody else. I suddenly had this idea.
You got the girl.
No, that was, I forgot. It was not interesting. Suddenly it was only the guitar. And I was very focused. And I wanted to be accepted at the conservatory. And so I played this one piece of music, the partita. And after that year, I could really play it well. And that I taught myself because the teacher thought, this is too soon, you just started guitar and you need to do the basics. And I inscribed and got to an audition with the professors. It's like, it's very prestigious. The conservatory and the university basically had the same kind of standard in guitar. And I got in, and they just thought I'm this wunderkind. And at the first lesson, then in September, I think all the other students would sit there, the youngest, and the professor would say, oh, Walter, so good to have you here now. Let's warm up. Can you play F sharp minor? And I said, I don't know how to play F sharp minor on guitar. And they thought, he's funny too. He can play it. He's funny. I said, no, I really don't know how to play it. I play for 1 year now, and I can play it. That Bach piece, silence. It was like incredible silence. I thought, oh my God, now they will kick me out. But that professor liked me and said, you know what? Okay, let's start from scratch. So they normally wouldn't do it. He taught me from the beginning, and it was a wonderful journey into guitar. And then guitar is such a different instrument, and every instrument is amazing, but also guitar again is a lonely instrument. It's like you have those fingernails, and if they break, you can play. And of course, as a teenage boy, having long fingernails on one hand and filing them and putting lac on so they don't break, it's not very great to be seen with other guys. But you always practice on your own. There's hardly any literature with other musicians. You never use a metronome. So you have your own rhythm feeling, your own emotional sense. And it's a very particular instrument.
Did you have any ambitions at that point to be, I mean, obviously there's some great guitarists from that era, you know, when you think about Hendrix or sort of Jimmy Page and people like that, but did you have any ambitions to be a great guitarist and get into rock and roll, given that you had been so moved when you heard Nutbush City Limits? You could have gone down that path and said, I'm just going to rock the world. But you didn't. You went down a different path. What was it that set you in a different direction?
It might sound incredibly pretentious, and I really don't mean it this way. To me, it wasn't, I want to be a guitarist. It was just it. I was in that world, and I didn't think 2 years, 3, 5 years ahead. It's like, I play guitar. I want to do it. I am doing it, and I do the best I can. I loved classical guitarists like Segovia and Bream, but also George Harrison and Gilmour. It's like, oh my God, it's like I'm seeing him live when he played. It's like Pink Floyd, David Gilmour. It's like,
oh, right. Gilmour, of course.
Robert Fripp. It's like, those, oh my God, those are just geniuses. And
oh, I tell you, I'm just going to jump in there. When you mentioned Robert Fripp, I think you probably left South by Southwest, and I went to see the Robert Fripp documentary. Incredible. I mean, talk about perfectionist. So it was, the film is called, or the documentary is called, In the Court of the Crimson King.
Like the record.
And he'd never allowed, Robert Fripp had never allowed anyone to document his story, because he never felt anyone could do justice. And he didn't really know what the documentary would be supposed to, the purpose of it would be, because he is such, obviously, a perfectionist. And, you know, after 50 years of practicing his art, you could say, and he allowed this documentarian in to follow them around. And it is extraordinary. And the only thing I can describe and compare it to is, I saw a film a few years ago called Jiro, The Art of Sushi, about a sushi restaurant in a Japanese station, about this one man that had been making sushi and have never perfected it for 50 years, 60 years. And it's the same thing, that he feels he's never quite achieved perfection, and he practices for hours a day still. And it's just incredible. So when you talk about David Gilmour and obviously Robert Fripp, he just made me think about just that pursuit of a belief of the, it's a craft that can never be perfected. And it's a life of exploration.
And especially King Crimson, always a very, very different. They were pioneers. It's and they went through many transformations, but they always were on the cutting edge. And so is Pink Floyd, but in a different way. It's like Pink Floyd, I think it's the band, but King Crimson, it seems, it is really Fripp's intellectual pattern, melody, composition style. It's really, really incredible. Well, I'm glad for you that you saw it. I have to check that out too.
I think you'll enjoy it.
Thank you for mentioning. And yeah, those guitarists are amazing. Then I know it's like now I'm 17 and band, and especially Gilmour, you see him so many times with his guitar and having a cigarette in the pegs. So I tried the same thing, but then it's like, I always wanted to smoke, but it was awful. And then the smoke goes in your eyes as you play. Like, it's like, I admired as a Gilmour for, how can you do this? Like playing guitar and having the cigarette in there and not blinking with the eyes. It was like a comedy for me. So I gave up smoking. It's like, I tried, but it didn't work out. Luckily,
And I realized you don't have to smoke to be a guitar player. And I really got so many times so lucky. Like, it's to be at the right place at the right moment. I remember another big thing that changed my life was I'm looking through a paper, music paper, and I see a picture of Giorgio Moroder somewhere in Hollywood in front of a swimming pool and playing a Roland Jupiter 8. It's like this monster keyboard. This is like now probably 1979, 80. So
that was after he'd worked with Donna Summer.
Yeah, exactly. And super successful. And I don't know, this picture, again, mesmerized. It's just him and the keyboard, basically. And I have this idea, I have to have this keyboard. I have to get a keyboard like this. And I'm a student at this time and having a couple of students, teaching them and doing sometimes a little film work or commercial work. And I remember it was 118,000 shillings. So at the time, probably $10,000-$12,000 or so. But I so knew I have to get this key. And I'm not a keyboard player, but I had to get this. So I took a loan. And funny enough, that bank person gave me that loan with no income. And I bought this and I got a little bit better deal because of the people at Roland. They were very supportive. So, wow. Want this? I think it was the second person or first person in Austria buying that, and I learned that in and out. It's like I spend again hours and hours, and I know this instrument so well, and programmed for other people. And at one time in the morning, it's like 9 o'clock in the morning, I'm getting a call from a studio where I've left that keyboard, and hey Walter, we need you. There's this classical composer Otto von Zugern who needs a specific sound. Can you do it? And I said, okay, and hop on the tram, and 15 minutes later, I'm at the studio, and here's this incredible musician, Otto M. Zugern. He was the first to play Schoenberg piano by memory, immense hearing, wrote operas, and it's this guy with a gray beard and like this professor musician, like Brahms kind of type. And he says, oh, Walter, I need this and this and this sound. Can you make it like that? And I want to have this emotion. And I kid you not, it's like okay, I did a little bit, and I got lucky as well, and he played it, and it's, oh my god, this is exactly what I needed, and played it, and it plays incredibly well. And then I hear the backstory is they tried for the last 2 days to find the good sounds for him. They always said no. So obviously then he said, Walter, we have to work together. And he's a guy who writes operas and is famous, and Bernstein wanted to collaborate with him. So like really like in that world, a known entity. Wow. And he became my mentor, and I adored him, and we really loved each other in like in a musical sense. And I learned so much that one phone call and that one picture. And then I programmed for Falco.
Serendipity is the core of why I do this podcast. And that seems to be a defining serendipitous moment.
Yes.
If you hadn't seen that image of Moroder, if you hadn't got the bank loan, if you hadn't left in the studio.
Yeah. And the next thing is, so the person who sold me that keyboard at the time called me when I came back to Vienna. He heard about it. And so I talked about that story, about the picture. That's why I bought it. And I know that picture. I can send it to you. And he sent me that picture. It's like, and it was just funny. So suddenly, this is now, whatever, 40 years later, I'm getting that picture again. It was just a beautiful cycle in that sense. And another serendipity was, like, I was postgraduate film scoring at USC, and amazing teachers, Jerry Goldsmith, Bruce Broughton, David Raxin, they were all there and were all teachers and amazing teachers. And at the end of the graduate studies, a friend of mine said, hey, Walter, Disney is looking for trailer composers. And I had no clue what a trailer was. It's like, is it more okay? And I think you would be perfect for this. You do classic and modern and this and that and sound.
This is when you were in LA. You'd gone to UC Berkeley, UC Southern California, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Film scoring. I'm not really taking it serious. It's like I never really worked for a company. And those other days, you had to send in a cassette with your work. So I had a Chrome, a TDK Chromium cassette, like those golden ones. And I yodeled a little bit and then I said, you know, I'm a pretty good composer. And if you really want to work with me, call me 213-500-5080, my cell phone number, and a cowbell and some cows walking off sound.
So wait a minute, this is a trailer, just an example of some sound composition, not specific to a particular brief or a trailer of a film.
It's just to get the job. It's like basically it was, you know, Disney. If you're interested to be a staff composer in the trailer department, send in your best work, preferably trailer music you've done and trailers you've done and resume and blah, 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 blah. It's like just a job description. Okay. So I just naively just send in this audio cassette and that's it. And 2 weeks later, I'm getting a call from Disney and saying, wow, it was really interesting. And it kind of blew us away. We're interested to talk to you. Please come by at Disney Studios. And so I'm driving up Disney Studios, like, oh my God, he's like this boy from Vienna. And it's like at the Disney Studios. It's like, this is, like, it's unbelievable. Wow. It's like if you grew up in Europe and you're suddenly there and you see things you've seen in movies. And we grew up with Disney movies and my heart is beating. And I had a good interview and they hired me and I learned a lot there and I worked for half a year. Fortunately, unfortunately, the director of the department was never there. I think he took it easy and let me do whatever. And so basically I was doing everything there and sometimes he came by and that was it. And so I really learned a lot and I got really thrown into the water and had fun with that. And
so you were doing trailers for what sort of movies?
There were times I went to the movie theaters and the probably 8 to 10 trailers and 5 of them were my music in Hollywood.
Wow.
And it was just beautiful feeling. It's like, oh my God, and this and that. And also trailers were different at the time. You really had somebody compose specifically for that trailer and work with an editor. It's very different though.
In a way, it makes sense because you had gone on to study film scoring, which is a question in its own right is why that specifically film scoring and not classical, some other form of sort of classical exploration or music. But it's funny when you think about the great film composers like so John Williams and Hans Zimmer, you know, you'd think that the trailers would be aspects and elements from what they've actually created.
When the trailers are produced, the composer hasn't even scored that movie. Sometimes teasers are a year before the movie gets released. They just barely start writing for it. So, and also the cuts are so different. You could take an amazing track of that score and try it on a trailer. It wouldn't work because it's edited quick and it's just 3 parts and often has like lead ups and the supers come in and if the score is something totally different, it's very different. And again, I learned to be really fast and I learned about this incredible machine in Los Angeles. You could get a job assignment to write something orchestral and have it done the next evening, done, mixed, deliver. You couldn't even dream of that in any other place in the world. It is so fantastic how everybody knows exactly what they have to do. And also in a beautiful way, never did more than that because sometimes we mean well and do a little bit more and that confuses the chain of commands. And it just really worked incredible. And you learn to write fast and to listen again. It's like you sit in a meeting with an editor and sometimes the director or the trailer department and they just give you the ideas and driving quickly home, writing and coming back with an audio cassette or with a dad tape at the time. And that was it. And it was fun. It's like every assignment is different. Like
comedies and rom-coms and this and that and here and there. It was the best school.
So what led you to go from that and to create your own business agency for a music company? Because many, with having done that, would have been drawn into working for a studio, having done film composition, and be going down that route. But you went down the entrepreneurial route. What drove you to that? Or what gave you just the confidence and the self-belief at such a young age?
It was the opposite. It was still this belief that I'm can be a good composer, and I'd rather do it without anybody looking how I'm doing it, because if I play a wrong note, nobody can see and hear it, and I can fix it. So it's totally the opposite. And so at the first assignment leaving Disney was because I thought I want to do it on my own and not just write for a person who is like in Palm Springs most of the time. And I was like, a lot of people knew me now and how I could write. And so I said, okay, I'll do my own thing. And I'm doing it from home and I don't have to drive to work. And the first assignment was to write music for Academy Awards. And I was thrilled and did that and recorded with a little orchestra. And when I got the paycheck, now this is the first paycheck as a individual contractor, they took out, I don't know, 50 or 60% of the check, and I couldn't believe it. And I was like, this must be wrong. And I said, yeah, if you basically, the tax system is, they think you make this money in one day, and then it's the highest, whatever, deductions and this and that and here and there. And I said, what can you do about this? Yeah, if you have a company, then it's different. I said, okay, I'll make a company. And the great thing in LA is, okay, so I want to be a company owner. What shall I do? And like, call a lawyer, and 10 hours later, you have your own company. And I remember going and like meeting with that lawyer, and we're going to the downtown building. And so the clerk says, so what's the name of your company? And oh my God, I don't have a company name. I don't want to call it Warzowa Company. And I remembered at the time, Volkswagen had this campaign about Fahrvergnügen. I'm sure you remember that. They had this one word. Every English person kind of knew it's a German funny word, Fahrvergnügen. And Vergnügen is enjoyment. I said, oh my God, maybe I should make it Musikvergnügen with German spelling. And I said, okay, Musikvergnügen. And it was like 10 seconds later, I said, oh, how do you spell this? Musikvergnügen. It's like, what? This is too long. I said, no, it's like, it's Fahrvergnügen. It's one word. I said, oh, those Germans, they stink. It's like so long words. And yeah, we just composite many things together. And then I realized, it was again luck, because everybody asked, how do you spell this? And
how do you pronounce it?
I pronounce it, and then they learn it. And so you do it, and then you crack up, and it's funny. And then if this was the Warzowa Company, people would never remember that.
Certainly a conversation starter, and it sticks in the memory.
Mm-hmm. So I got lucky there as well, and then met young graphic students, and we hit it off and talked about music and the philosophy of music and sound and light and synesthesia. And they got very successful, and I grew with them. And one is Kyle Cooper, I think the number one motion designer in history. His big thing was Seven, the main titles to Seven at the time. And
it's wonderful.
He really changed the whole motion design. And one thing led to another. And then at one time, Imagineering Forces called me and said, hey, we're working on this movie. It's Schwartz.
Who called you?
Imagineering Forces. It's a design company. At the time, it was RGA LA. There's RGA New York and RGA LA.
Oh, because it was, so it was when Bob Greenberg was doing work for things like Aliens and that.
One of the first ones, and Terminator was the great thing with it. Mercury running down a glass and like those things form. And he started all this stuff. Like, Greenberg is just such a vision, still is. And then New York just is one of those entities. And big awe, like the people he groomed. It's like Kyle Cooper and Garson Yu and Peter Frankfurt. They all come from that school, and like a brand new school. Mm. It's like, this is so many design companies, successful design companies, were all born at RGA, which became Imaginary Forces later on. And at one time, I know Garson Yu called and said, there's this movie in Schwarzenegger, and I know the director hates the main title of the composer, and I really don't like it. I want the design looks great and can you do something? And I said, okay, I'll try. When do you need it by tomorrow? So he sent me the main title and Alan Silvestri was the main composer there. And I did something overnight, sound design and music, and delivered in the morning. They loved it and they left it in there. And which like was politically a little bit awkward. And then I met Schwarzenegger afterwards and everybody thought that Schwarzenegger got me in there because we're Austrians and I met him because of that job. And again, this was this little moments being down the right. And then a couple of other movies, like even where once they were not happy with Philip Glass and I had to replace the main title. And there was like those moments and everything was one step, next step. But I never had this drive. I want to be there in 2 years. I want to make this money or this successful or this award or that award. It was just having fun to work and having these possibilities to see amazing visuals and writing music to it. And that is so much fun and so much joy.
You're probably bored senseless of recounting the story of the thing that you're often interviewed about, which is the Intel Inside sort of audio mnemonic. Having built a reputation and a network and connection with such incredible sort of graphic and design talents, as you're mentioning, what then opened up the door to creating that work for Intel?
Again, it was something that just happened. Nobody can plan that. Kyle Cooper, working at RGA at the time as junior designer, called me and was something like, hey, Walter, I have this job, Intel. And I had no clue what Intel was. I'm a Apple Mac person. I have no clue. And it's this company and they want to have a little signation sound. And I said, okay, I'll meet you at the agency. And he shows me the storyboard, like six pictures of the Intel spiral, how it develops. And with the Intel and then the slogan Intel Inside at the bottom and says, so if you need some music, I think it was Thursday or Friday. And it's just a little like 3 seconds. It can't be longer than 3 seconds. And we need something on Monday. And yeah, it should wrap up. And Intel had a genius model. They said they would basically reimburse half of the media buy, 25% with product, 25% money. If you use that OM, that mnemonic in the end, and Pioneer, many companies, they used, of course, the Intel processors. So at that time, I didn't know what a processor really looked like. I never opened up computers. This was the beginning when it all started. Like the normal person on the street had no clue what a processor was. And here you have to advertise for processor, something you can't touch. If you touch it, it would break. And nobody really knows why you would need it. It's something which makes the computer run better, but I don't know. And Intel was only for certain engineers a name, but definitely nothing like now that everybody knows the name. I'm driving home and think 3 seconds, that's easy. But then when I sit down, you can barely say a smart sentence in 3 seconds. It's like, you say something, it's just 3 seconds and it has a beginning, middle, and an end. And stand. So I realized it was annoyingly difficult to do that. And there were no use cases before. There were no mnemonics out there. And I got really frustrated. Nothing, Thursday, nothing. I think I tried to listen to Beatles and Bach and whatever and find little motifs and nothing made sense. And Sunday, it's like I'm really starting to freak out Sunday morning and I'm sitting in front of my piano and I have that board in front of me and I'm looking at it and I don't know if I should make circular music or it's like nothing was really resonating. And suddenly my eyes fall on the slogan Intel Inside, that tagline they're having. And I thought, so if this was a song, it would be a song with four different notes. And since they're very precise and concise engineers, it could be it should be a rhythm which is very even, pum 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 pum, like 4-8 notes. And it should be something which is powerful, not emotional. And they said also that any music culture should relate to it. So it can't have like a minor second which would feel Arabic, or that minus six which is too emotional Western classic music. So there were two intervals which came to mind. It's the fourth and the fifth, which are powerful, open, and have not too much emotional connotation other than being strong. And so that, okay, we'll start 1-4-1-5, played it and thought it's a nice little melody, and talked to Carl Cooper about it. I mentioned what the story is, and oh, that sounds interesting. How does it sound like? And I played it. Oh, it's good. And then we played it for Intel, and same thing. Wow, it's a good story. How did it sound? Oh, it sounds good. And that was it. And we worked for 2 or 3 months on the sound. That was really painfully. It's like, also in those days, there was not really good internet. They are up north in California. And I remember every day I would lay 3-4 versions onto 3/4-inch tape. You know, those 3/4-inch
tapes. Oh, this remember must have been driving you insane. Yeah.
Laying it back, FedEx it up there. Intel is so huge that they could only listen to it at 2 o'clock because it takes so long to bring a 3/4-inch tape into the creatives room at Intel headquarters. Then at 2 o'clock, we had a 1-hour call, like for 3 months or so, every day, listening to another gink, gink, gink. Maybe one a little bit more blue. No, a little bit more electric. No, a little bit more organic. No, a little bit this, a little bit that. And those were hundreds and hundreds of different versions. And then finally it happened. And I think we finalized because we really had to go on air, and that was it. And the rest is history.
Wow. Can you just explain for people that aren't musicians what tonic to subdominant structure is?
So when we play melodies, every note has a relationship to the next one and the prior one. And it's almost like a mathematical pattern. So when you are in a certain key, you can say the name of the key is the tonic, is that first step. Mm-hmm. If we are in the key of C, C is the one, is the tonic. It's the, in a classical sense, that note you expect to end the melody. It grounds it. It's a resolution. You have landed. You're done. And in the good classical music, if you have a symphony in C, it will end up on a C chord. And usually from 5 to 1. So it has a really great resolution. So you can go up for like on those white keys on the piano. You can imagine this. You can go up 4 steps. That's a fourth. So 4 notes that will bring you to the F. Then you go back to the C, and then you go 5 steps up to the G. And that's basically that 1-4-1-5. So it's very mathematical. It's a pattern. And it also looks good when you draw it up and makes mathematical sense and can be equated to a lot of other things. And it's something very powerful and open.
It's interesting because it was the very much the early days of what's now become known as sonic branding and sonic logos. And everyone's jumping on that bandwagon today. And I, you know, for people say that in the future, every brand will have its sonic branding, to the sense that, you know, a lot of brands like even MasterCard have even dropped the term MasterCard and moving towards just visual and sonic. When you look at the landscape now and you listen to them, is there anything that you go, oh, these guys have got it right? And then there are other ones you think you should go back to the drawing board.
To me, one of the most powerful one is Southwest Airlines. Because it's such a cheeky, incredible story behind it again. Boeing has a UI sound, a user interface sound. So when the fasten seatbelt sign is prompted, you have that clink sound. That is the Boeing
generated sound for fasten seat belts. Southwest Airlines licensed that sound for their branding, which is one of the most incredible things. So on every other competitor's Boeing plane, you hear that sound, which is actually the competitor. And Boeing allowed that to get licensed. I'm sure they pay a lot of money for this. So to me, it can't get better than that. That's just brilliance, political brilliance. And it's a great sound and everybody knows it and you hear it and think Southwest. So it definitely works. And it's interesting that so many times the sound, the timbre of the sound is so much more powerful than the melody. Over the last 2 decades, I spoke in Hong Kong to God knows where about Intel, and I like to test the audience. And I play sounds and say, please raise the hand when you recognize what it is. And I might do James Bond and the guitar and stuff like this. And I have also this one snippet where I play the Intel mnemonic melody with one different note, but something which kind of music could make sense. 1-3-1-5, which is just a nice chord arpeggio in that sense, but same tempo on a violin. And people definitely don't get that. Then I play the perfect melody, like the 1-4-1-5. But still people, some recognize the melody. Then I play the sound of this strange marimba electric sound there is with a different melody, and people immediately, all of them raise their hand. So the sound quality is more of a pointer than the melody, which is very interesting.
Interesting, that is, yeah.
And if you hear stuff like, I think it's Hard Day's Night, or like some of those iconic tracks, you only need half a second and you know what the track is. So there's no real music listened to it. It's the sound quality, which is so powerful.
I've just got off a tangent. I mean, all of us have transitioned to some form of music platform from, you know, whether it be Spotify to Apple Music to any of the others. You know, it might be Amazon Music or Google Music. But I mean, after being an early iTunes devotee, I then was an early adopter of Spotify and built up all my library and soundtracks and everything only recently to have moved back to Apple because of the quality and the dynamism of the music. And there's something in the quality of it, with particularly with the new headphones, the AirPods. What is that? Why is it that I can't go back to Spotify, because the actual experience, it just isn't the same as when I walk around and I've got this dynamic sound. What causes that? Because it's a visceral emotional reaction.
Sound quality. And you're absolutely right. There are many factors. One is the LUFS, which is a very clever maximizer dynamic range. In the olden days, and we had to deliver music in broadcast minus 18 dB. So it has enough headroom and it doesn't destroy the amplifiers of your system at home and the machines which air the system, the signal. So there's a lot of headroom in there. Then when the CD really and the digital world came to us, suddenly we were always basically 0 dB the loudest a tape or even a digital device can take. If it would be over that, it's just distortion and you can't listen to it. So they mastered it just barely under the minus 0.1. So it's really loud. And when you look at those tracks, it's like basically they look like this. They're super loud, and loud is a qualitative better. I can play two pieces of music to you, and if they're similar and one is louder, you 99% will say the louder one is a better track. Loud is better, and there's a fight, and there's amazing machines to make it even louder and appear louder. And now finally they realized something gets lost, that the dynamic, like when you listen to that old Beatles track or Presley track, there's quietness and then loud. It's again, you can see those waves that go, they look like this. And Britney Spears basically have one line and then it stops. And that's the dynamic of a track, the breathing of a track, that how it you can engage with it, and it's too much information for your ears. And if that is an MP3, which has basically errors because it's compressed, so your brain has to make up connections, then it's draining for your brain. And in health, we really know bad audio quality, bad MP3 files are really not good for your health. And so you're absolutely right in what you're saying, that if the quality is not absolutely good, it is, you don't know why, but it really affects you.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay, well, that's a nice segue to talking of health, audio health, to take us to your innovation. And we obviously, you were jumping from 1993 from Intel, and obviously there's a large body of work you did between 93 and setting up in 2015 HealthTunes. But maybe you could just talk to us about why you set up what you describe as the streaming digital pharmacy of searchable by symptoms, offering evidence-based music to help. And from what I believe, it was done to scratch your own itch or to treat your son Luca's condition that he was suffering from, because Western medicine couldn't actually address the issues. So
when Luca, my son, was 5, he developed leg pertes. Leg pertes is this strange illness, disease, symptom where the femur falls apart. So basically the hip joint falls apart and regrows. And that process can take 6 years. It's very painful. And you can imagine for a young boy, just devastating. You can't walk. Mm. And there was not a ton of literature out there and different opinions with different hospitals and surgery and laying in bed or having metal braces or this and that. And luckily, my wife had the sense to opt into osteopathy, acupuncture, strict diet, and sound healing. And also at that time, I got lucky. I built a music production house, and that was acquired by BMG. And I thought, I want to take it a little bit easy now. And after Lucas really fast recovery, a year later he was running again, I thought, I want to do something in that world. I want to give back and be able to help other very sad, frustrated parents which have to go through this. And first it was really strictly about leg pertes, and the hospitals ask us, I've never seen something like this, that the boy would run after that severe leg pertes a year later and he's
Was this in LA or in Austria?
Los Angeles. And we talked to USC and UCLA. The great American spirit that is, that they were curious, how did you guys do that? And I know in many other countries it would be, oh, this is impossible, and we know what we're doing, and you can't do it on your own. So it was, and partnerships started, and we of course shared what we did and how we did, and it really pointed that music and sound was a huge important part in that healing. And so I'm a technophobe, and I thought, I want to put a platform together where anybody anywhere could tap into that. And that was the beginning of HealthTunes. Then I realized that music can do so much more. Like in chronic pain, even epilepsy, we learned that there's something like drug-resistant epilepsy. So there are patients, especially kids, there's no medicine for them because it's drug-resistant. There is one piece of music. It's a Mozart piece for four hands, the KV-448, that reduces seizures by 70%.
Wow.
And there are two professors, one is in Salzburg, one is in Prague, who really studied like deeply into that, and they're trying to find other music which does the same. Nobody has found anything closely to that. This piece of music is working like an incredible piece with medicine. That's why I call my service a pharmacy, a digital pharmacy. You can prescribe music.
Like you say, one piece of Mozart music composition works against one condition to such an efficacious degree. How do you, what's the process of discovery? to identify one condition against a certain type of user. Is there an algorithm you've developed to do that?
I have an algorithm to optimize it. It's a lot of observation. There's something called music therapy where they research that and have wonderful clinic studies and try different pieces of music. Barely anybody can say this music works for that because it is about trying and finding the efficacy. The only time where you really know why it is working and what is working is in Alzheimer's with lyric recall. So when you sing along to a track, your lyric memory is in a different part in the brain than the speaking memory, when you talk about something. And those centers most of the time get attacked much later than the speaking. And I've seen and there's studies about this that Alzheimer's dementia patients who are not able to communicate anymore start singing along with a track they remember from their childhood. With that, the brain oxygenates and becomes more active and brings you out of that dementia phase. You can't heal Alzheimer's this way, but you can definitely stop it in a sense and can find the patient and communicate with the patient in that moment again. And it's like a miracle. It's like you...
Wow, that's incredible.
Those patients change. And so in that sense, you know, okay, this person loved the Beatles when she was 20 years old and sang those songs, and now she is 80 years old and loves to sing them, and you played those songs and she remembers them and has them deep memory, and that is getting uncovered and she tunes in. Another thing is what we instinctively do, and phylogenetically, mothers, when the baby is uneasy, you take the baby to your chest with the head close to the heart on the skin. And the baby is basically listening to the breathing, feeling the breathing and the heart rate of the mother, and that entrains. So we take this process in music. Preemies often, when they are in pain, have a heart rate of 190. And there's videos where we use music and we align the music to 190 beats per minute as well, and have an algorithm to slow down the music, and that baby's heart rate follows. It entrains.
Wow.
And goes to 155 in a minute, no medication needed. And those are miracles. And it's so powerful. And sometimes there are days I think music entertains us, but the real reason why for music is medicinal.
Mm-hmm. Beyond that, it would suggest that music plays a much bigger part in how we are, let's say, coded as humans. That there's something bigger at play. If it is therapeutic, then there's something we don't really understand about the nature of music and its how it's woven into the fabric of life.
Yeah, and I think we don't have to understand it. Maybe it even works better because we don't understand it. And I'm a pretty scientific person, but I think I believe in science and magic, as weird as it sounds. And if you know that this track does that and you tried it 100 times and 99 times it really worked, I don't know why. It's magic, but there's science, there's research behind it, testing behind it. Some of it is really in clinic studies with double blind testing control groups, and it works. And actually, it doesn't matter why it works, it's important that it works.
Mm-hmm. So where are you in terms of working with clinicians and medical researchers about looking at different medical conditions? I mean, obviously, there's so much research going on. And I was at my partner's uncle's birthday party last weekend and ended up speaking to two Scottish doctors from the Mayo Clinic. I've been there 40 years, and fascinating hearing the work and research that still goes on today in terms of gastroenterology. But also, you know, you think about everything that's been happening with conditions, obviously with COVID and vaccines to sort of address. And I spoke to someone else doing a lot of work in RNA, mRNA vaccines, and how that will become a revolutionary sort of piece of technology to address future illnesses. So how do you work with when you've got something that's so revolutionary as music therapy? How do you then collaborate with other medical researchers to combine forces?
Yeah, the only way to communicate with them is through evidence-based research, because there are plenty of music platforms out there, and I'm not talking for or against them, but it's incense, swaying, sitar playing, and that's your life, and I'll make you change. But you have, but in the hospitals, it's a different system. You have to be safe about it. It has to be replicable. It has to have efficacy, and it has to be plausible. And that's what we do with, and that makes the big difference. And there's no other competitor out there. There are many platforms with music, but everything is evidence-based. And that opened up the doors right now at WellStar Health in Atlanta. They have 300 hospitals. They're rolling out experience rooms with health tunes and immersive audio, and have extremely high success. And they are hospital clinical environment, so they have the research, the research data, and how to get the biometrics going. And it's they couldn't believe how powerful and successful it is, and how people like it. And so we are not talking against taking medication. It's like we need doctors, we need surgery when it's needed, but a lot of it can be amplified and optimized with music. And we need also simple solutions. It's such an expensive world, hospitals. If music can help to reduce the hospital stay by 10-15%, then hospital doesn't lose money. It's like there's only gains. The patient is out sooner, which they like. The cost per patient is reduced by 10-15%. And the hospitals have the next person waiting there anyway. So it's a plus plus even for the payers. We would like to work more with payers because they will see what they can save. They can save a lot of money. And right now with isolation, so many people have mental challenges because they are alone. And music, with music, you are not alone anymore. And music is to connect. Music is to feel something else, get new emotion and vago stimulation going. So especially now, music is an incredible, powerful modality.
So you have a platform that people can sign up to, HealthTunes.
HealthTunes.org, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So how does that work if someone was to sign up there? They're not in hospital. How do they identify and how do you work with them to assign the right music therapy for them? Just if anyone's interested in, let's say, has someone that's suffering from a condition.
Yeah, I was just mesmerized by how simple Apple makes everything work. So I thought, is there a way to get what you are asking with 3-4 keystrokes or searches? And so once you're in HealthTunes, and it's a browser app, it's an Android app, an iOS app, you basically log in, so it's personalized to you, and you type in whatever symptom or target diagnosis you have. This might be chemotherapy side effects, it might be epilepsy, it might be pain or sleep or Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, it's like you name it, and you'll find that there. Then the next step is the liking of music, because there is, of course, let's say in Alzheimer's, music, if you love rock and roll, I give you rock and roll. If you like classic, you give a classic or jazz. It's like it really depends on, you need to like that music, and you're there. And you click a button and you can get into that therapy and you can read up why it's helping as well, because we have all the research and attached to it. So it's basically two searches and you get what you're looking for.
Amazing. Have you ever reflected on the fact that you've come full circle from your father and you're being in medicine?
I knew you would point that out. Yes.
Yeah.
We're laughing about this. It's like I couldn't escape. He got me then.
Yeah, eventually.
Yes.
Just reeled you back in.
But with a different perspective, I don't have to deal with drawing blood and And I touch the people emotionally, but not physically.
Do you think it has a place? I mean, I think, you know, you've obviously made great strides with the application of this, but it feels like we're still in the early days of music therapy. That, I mean, I've got a couple of clients that are psychotherapists, and I spoke to one of them about it, and she said, oh yeah, it's something that we are sort of very aware of and would be certainly interested in working with. They deal with children and ADHD and yeah. autism. So I think there is a growing awareness of the value of music therapy. But in terms of obviously coming out of COVID, it's been a great reset. People are questioning whether they want to go back to the workplace. And there's a time for opportunity for organizations to reimagine the workplace.
Mm-hmm.
Are you working with any businesses or organizations to rethink the way that music is used to create, let's say, happier, more healthier workplaces if and when people go back?
Absolutely. And it does not matter if you go back to your office or at home. We offer corporate wellness that could be used to the companies. And then, of course, the person's discretion. Start the day with a specific therapy, which is personalized to your needs, and start a working day this way or end it this way. And the companies, they would allow, if this is a 20-minute therapy, they say you can take 10 minutes as personal time and 10 minutes we paid for. Some even say the whole 20 minutes are on us. We know that you're more productive and happier this way. And it's even team building if you listen together in those experience rooms. And yeah, it's really getting there. It's like I can sense that energy and that openness about it.
That's great. If someone that hears this and wants to reach out to you, how would they go about connecting to maybe come and do a consultation for their business?
Definitely. Just email us info@healthness.org or me personally, Walter@healthness.org. And either myself or a professional doctor will get back to you and we'll answer. And we're very open to create corporate wellness. I think that's a powerful way to get out of isolation, out of depression, out of inactivity, and getting into connectivity in a sense.
So before we move on to quick fire questions, I had read that you've been doing some really interesting work also with artificial intelligence. You're obviously sort of a pretty busy individual during the pandemic, and you have completed the unfinished Beethoven's 10th Symphony. So could you just give us a little abridged version as to why and how?
Again, serendipity. I was asked by a Philharmonic in Vienna to arrange the second movement, 7th Symphony of Beethoven, for a very specific virtuoso group in film-style music. And then they used that in Tokyo at Future Lab, it's a museum. And it really turned out great, wonderful recording of this musician. And I was so proud of it that I sent that. I don't know why I sent it, but I sent it to Matthias Röder, who is head of Karajan Institute in Salzburg. And I know him, and I thought, well, this worked out great. Maybe he likes it. A week later, he calls back and says, hey, Walter, would you like to write with Beethoven? And, you know, if somebody calls you out of the blue and says, you want to write with Beethoven, you write. And I want to also sing with George Harrison and live next week. And I don't know, and fly to Mars the next week. No. They might do this later. But right now, do you want to finish the 10th Symphony? And I said, are you serious? Yes, I'm serious. We have a team of Harvard, and Rutgers, and Cornell professors. And we need a composer. And there's a technical liaison between the AI department and the world of music creativity. That's fine. This guy is serious. Like, of course, I said yes. And like, and that's my mantra for life. And I would suggest to stand up, just say always yes. And then regret it later on. Of course, I had sleepless nights. And I said, oh my God, why did I say yes? But I said yes. And we met them. We learned so much. We made tons of mistakes, learned with every mistake. And that was the beauty, like Rutgers University, Ahmed El-Gabal is he's the AI person in creativity. And it was always
productive. It's like, it's never felt like we failed, but it was important to get to the next step and next step. And suddenly that symphony was done and we performed it in Bonn first and then in Hamburg, and then it was performed in Dubai and last week in Taiwan, and it will open up the Corinthian summer, and it made in the charts, it got, I think, number 2 in the album charts. And it's like, oh my God, it's like, I'm sure Beethoven is proud of it as well. And I'm super proud. And
where can we listen
breathing.
To it?
Mm-hmm. It's where on can Spotify. We listen to it? If you type in Spotify.
Why not?
You can.
Apple Music.
Yeah, it's like, and there's a CD available as well. And you can type in my name, Beethoven 10, and it comes up. And it's wonderful. A great recording with Cameron Carpenter. He's the world's best organist. It's like I bow down to him. He's just incredible what he did. And it was such a beautiful experience. And we did it to show the world how important creativity is and that technology can help us to be more creative. We're not saying that AI is replacing us. We would like to give that algorithm to the world and have fun and create. Only less than 2% of the world is living off of creativity. As kids, we are super creative. Something is happening. We need to be more creative. And that's my mantra. Be creative with everything. You can be creative in business. You can be creative driving the car differently. Take a different route the next day and start with little steps and write music, like poetry, paint, invent something, just enjoy it.
I mean, there are so many different views in terms of where that we will go with the future of AI and humanity, and there's dystopian and utopian views. But I think it is, you know, I think you're absolutely right that it opens up the opportunity for us as artificial intelligence and general artificial intelligence can take away the non-creative aspects of our life. It opens up pathways, unimaginable pathways for opportunities to change how we think about education of our children, to inspire us to become much more curious, more creative, more fulfilled humans. And I think it is exciting, the work you're doing. We have a question about what do you want your legacy to be? But I think what you're doing, you've almost answered that. But I wonder if there is something else beyond inspiring people to be more creative.
To be inspiring in a little and for the humanity. And I love those projects which impact and make people's lives more interesting and fun and inspire. Being a good father is important as well. Mm-hmm. And trying is... But also knowing that I'm in peace, it's like whatever I'm doing, it's like I'll try the best I can and know that I can't be the perfect father, but I think I want to be a good father.
How old are your children?
27, 25, 15.
I mean, obviously they've passed the point, the 20-year-olds are past the point where you have to worry about them being sucked into the spiral of social media. But what's your view in terms of how, as parents, have to deal with children that are getting drawn into things like TikTok addiction, where potentially it's damaging to creativity?
You know, I don't think that TikTok per se is damaging. It's how much you glue to it. I think for the first time ever in history, anybody can be creative, film yourself and be seen by the world and can be successful. Mm-hmm. 30 years ago, you had to be really lucky that a record company likes you, invests in you and does that. And that's so much easier now. So TikTok can be the incredible creativity distribution. You can see it as this, but you also can see it as intrusive. Mm-hmm. And like anything, like a knife can kill you and a knife can save your life from surgery.
Okay. Should we move the quick fire questions?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What principles do you stand by?
Balance.
Like balance in terms of
that we have to avoid being so extreme anymore, and it's not the good and the bad. It's like being in balance. It's like, I think nature in balance is your physiology in balance is when you are at ease and when everything plays together. And
where mm-hmm. everything suddenly makes sense and nothing's overpowering and there's no power fight, no power struggle.
Okay. Hard choices. What hard choices have you made that might have felt tough at the time, but when in retrospect you look back, they were the right decisions?
Perseverance, that I would never give up. And so many times, especially as a composer, I heard, oh my God, this is shit. Why did you do this? And going back, don't discuss and make another one.
Yeah, the perseverance of completing that Intel project an example of that.
Yes.
I mean, you're an innately creative person as a sound inventor. Where do you go? Where do you find new ideas?
In my dreams, a ton I dreamt of. So it's inside myself. Mm-hmm. And then I love to travel and see different things. And creativity is to see things from a different perspective. And they're even trying to measure now. It's like universities. Can you measure creativity? And it's basically that one experiment where I give you an object and tell me what comes to mind with the object. If I say brick, some people might say build a house, build a wall. And some people might say you can file your nails on it, you can break a window with it, and you can try to cook it and eat it. And that's creativity, where like you have connections in your brain which are so far stretched and unexpected. And the Picassos, they found something new. It was a quantum leap in creativity, and it's unexpected and bold. And I think the word bold is very important for creativity.
Yeah, for sure. What is the one problem worth solving?
I am so convinced if everybody can play out their creativity, that the world would be a better place.
Certainly, from the answers we get to this question, that range from everything from really climate is a major part of it and our political divide. I suppose when we can, it's all about solving problems. And if creativity is the heart of solving problems, then you're probably right. It probably sits at the top of the pyramid.
Yes, absolutely.
You've got an opportunity to invite four people from history around for dinner in Vienna or LA to help you plan for a better future.
Are they sitting with me or are they cooking?
Well, I think you're doing the cooking and they're there okay. to help you solve the world's future problems. Who would those people be, alive or dead? They don't have to be.
Of course, Nikola Tesla, because Einstein. Then we need those a different poetic force in the Rumi. And then because
Iranian, Persian poet.
Yeah, the emperor of music, Johann Sebastian Bach.
Bach. And not Mozart.
You know, Mozart and Beethoven might have had a similar experience when they heard Bach for the first time than when I can relate to the incredible letters about when they discovered Bach, how they felt.
Okay. For those who maybe a link to that, and I might follow up and see if I can put something in the show notes for that.
Mm-hmm.
A question no one asks you that you wish they would, or stop asking you. Don't ask me about Intel anymore.
I think the big question is always around creativity, and I love to talk and find ways for myself and for everybody around me to unleash the creativity and the joy of being creative.
Okay. What would your advice be to someone who's about to graduate study that might have a great ambition, but has been told by people around them, forget it, that's impossible?
Don't think about the future as your whole life. Think about the next week, what you enjoy and what you can do now to grow that week. Even though Will Smith totally fell out of graces, I listened to his audiobook. And he talks about it as a boy, and his father made him build a wall. And they spent, I think, from February till September, he and his brother to build the wall. Then one point, the father is listening to Will, and he's complaining, we'll never finish the wall. And the short story is, the father says, look at this, what is this?
It's a brick dead. Think about one brick at a time, and you lay the brick and you're done with the brick, and don't think about the wall, because then you will always feel you never finish. And that is something as simple as this is. If you look for a job now, don't think about that swimming pool you need to have and the whole family and the big this and that and success or not. Enjoy the moment again, and whatever is your creativity, what is your language, trust in it and have fun with it. Don't be scared. Because scared is
That's
the
great advice.
Antidote to everything. And if you're different, oh, maybe there's one helping story. Like when I started, we were 8 students at USC. That year, we got assignments, and pretty much every assignment, 7 sounded similar, and one was very different. And I always delivered something different. I had fun. I didn't do it for the sake of it. I just felt differently. And I think that is a big part of my success.
Okay. For thought. You're a composer. We've got to ask a karaoke question. What would be your go-to karaoke song?
I have the worst singing voice, and I know that. And I don't go to karaoke. If Avo Parent, like the classical composer, the karaoke song, I would pick him. But it's probably a Beatles song, like In a La Prayer or something. Something joyous.
Okay, then, right. A TV series or a film or a documentary that you've seen recently that you think someone should watch?
For me, a film is a social gathering, and I saw Dune with my whole family, and I enjoyed that because the film is it's amazingly made, and the music is incredible. Hans Zimmer, it's really incredibly well produced and composed and made, and it was just great to have the family around, and that great just amazing visuals and the great score. It was good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I haven't seen it yet, so I'll make sure I sort of put that on my list as well.
Yeah.
Okay, we offer a book to a listener that comes up with good comments on Instagram or on the website. What would that book be that we should offer them?
I think also tying into that one question about advice for students, The Creativity Code, Marcus du Sautoy. He's a mathematician at Oxford.
That.
It reads like a thriller. It's from the Go computing to creativity to AI and music. And it's incredible. It opens up the doors to that world.
Okay. We'll put that on the list and definitely I'll read that myself. It sounds good. And final question, who should we interview next?
Beethoven.
Well, no, we can't do that unless you've got some sort of an incredible way of bringing back a holographic reality of Beethoven. a good answer.
Because that, I'll do everything. I'll help you. I'll dig him out. Like the partner I have now, Michael Plitkins, he founded Spatial, that immersive experience. And the short story is like perseverance. 5 years ago, he called me. And he is a very powerful person who just, his company got acquired and he called me to set up a system, a sound system for his house, family, and the reptiles he is running around in his huge garden. And I realized that he wants something which wasn't possible. And I said, you know, you have the funds, you're a technician and engineering, just why don't you make a company doing this? Nobody can do what you want. I don't want to just take your money and like, I'm sure you can do it. And I think he was first a little bit miffed that I would answer like this. Half a year later, he calls his Walter to get advice. I started a company. And I have a person from like the director of the iPhone and the CEO of LucasSound. That's like the most amazing people. And fast forward 5 years, he's presented that company now, it's South by Southwest, and it was not successful. It was hugely successful. It's incredible.
What's it called?
Spatial. Spatial. It's the immersive audio experience, which is speak agnostic, which is the incredible part. It's basically a software service. You
can have it at home, you can have it in hospitals, you can have this in your cars, in shopping centers, you name it, and it turns your room into an immersive paradise.
Interesting, when we think about the future of automotive and autonomous vehicles and what those will be, when we have those space, how that transportation space is going to change. That's really interesting. When you bring that together with spatial and what you're doing with health, you could imagine the future of how we think about moving from A to B changes dramatically. That's very interesting. Okay.
So I'll introduce you to Michael Pitkins. He is one of these incredible thinkers, and he is in the middle. I don't know if he will share it. He's changing with what he's doing and what the plans are, and it's powerful and inspiring.
Wonderful. Okay, well, thank you for that. Look forward to the connection. Well, Walter, it's been wonderful for you to share the time and your great wisdom and answers the questions, and just acknowledge you for your humbleness and your just inspiration and how you've applied your curiosity and creativity to solving to an incredible body of work that probably most people aren't aware of, but have probably heard so much of your work and don't have the, can now put a name to it, but also the work you're doing to make the world a healthier, better place through, again, the creativity through HealthTunes. And so thank you. And I think we're just at the beginning of the next phase of world-changing applications that you're developing. So it's been a pleasure. So thank you very much.
Thanks for that wonderful hour we had together and inspiring questions. Have a great day in beautiful, hot Austin. Send me some of that heat.
I will. It'll be coming to you soon, I'm sure, in Austria.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, that's all for this week, folks. If you're enjoying the show, please either follow, download, or subscribe on your preferred podcast player. We'd also appreciate a rating and a review, as it helps more people find us. And if you have a guest you think we should interview, just email us at info@theimpossiblenetwork.com or message us on Instagram at The Impossible Network. This is a Fabrica Collective production. So have a great week, and we'll be back next time with another inspiring guest on The Impossible Network.